protect the people's rights and have a secure presidential vote on Friday. The Yemeni army says it's carried out a fresh retaliatory drone strike on Saudi Arabia's Asir province. And Ivory Coast security forces clash with supporters of former President Laurent Gbagbo, who is returning home for the first time in nearly a decade. Hi, everybody. Welcome to World News from Tehran with me, Behrouz Najafi. Let's start this bulletin with the latest updates regarding Iran's presidential election in the other studio.
Welcome to Election Special. Thank you for joining us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has renewed his call for a huge voter turnout in the country's upcoming presidential election. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei urged people from all walks of life to participate in Friday's vote, irrespective of their political persuasions, arguing that the problems of the country won't be resolved if people refrain from voting. The 13th presidential election in the Islamic Republic of Iran will be held on Friday. With the voting just one day away, less than 24 hours, Iran's Interior Ministry and the Election Commission have made all the necessary preparations for the big day. The Election Commission says there are nearly 67,000 polling stations available. Officials say the number of voting places has increased to alleviate concerns about the coronavirus pandemic. Over 59 million people are eligible to vote in the June 18 election, but the election will not just be held in Iran. We are now going to take a closer look at the candidates and what their plans are for the next 4 years. Abdel Nasser Himmati, 64 years old, has a PhD in economics from the University of Tehran, where he is currently an associate professor. Himmati teaches macroeconomics and energy economics at other universities too. Over the past years, he has also held other posts. In 1989, he was appointed as the vice president of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting for a five-year term from May 2016 until June 2018. Himmati served as the governor of the Central Insurance of Iran, a leading agency in charge of regulating the country's insurance industry. After that, Himmati was appointed as the governor of the central bank and remained at the post until the end of May this year. Himmati is now running for Friday vote, like other presidential candidates. Well, just like other candidates, as I said, he has spoken of plans to address the issues the country is facing if he wins the top executive post. The most serious issues to be addressed, according to Himmati, are inflation, unemployment, and housing. He says in order to resolve those issues and many more, he will make changes in the way the economic affairs are managed. He also says to improve the economy, he will boost domestic production and work on plans to attract foreign investment. Himmati has also pledged to bring drug trafficking under control and tackle issues surrounding the environment. He says his possible government will work on plans that help low-income families get better health care and education services. Himmati believes a fair distribution of wealth will help the country overcome the current economic crisis. Let's take a listen.
I'm an economist and I know what's going on in the country in terms of the economic situation we are in right now. We don't have enough resources to fulfill all the promises the candidates are making. I don't want to lie just to garner votes. My colleagues are not talking about generational wealth. They're talking about generational poverty. We need fair distribution of wealth.
On women and youth, Himmati is critical of what he sees as meaningless restrictions for the two groups. He says the youth are not happy with the current situation because there is too much pressure on them. Himmati believes some fundamental changes are needed to witness more active presence of the young people in social and economic fields. on foreign policy. Hemeti believes what the country is most suffering from is illegal sanctions imposed by the U.S. He says the sanctions are cruel and have directly affected the livelihood of ordinary people. The presidential candidate says he is determined to remove sanctions if elected president. Here's more.
JCPOA is an important issue. I'm determined to implement the agreement. The current government is also committed to the nuclear deal. I hope that the United States returns to the JCPOA and fulfill its commitments in a verifiable way. Iran has already made its stance clear and will undoubtedly abide by its commitments. I hope sanctions will be removed as soon as possible, and that too will be one of my priorities. We need interactions with the world. No country has achieved a proper economic growth and development unless it has a serious interaction with the world. I announce to you that I support serious economic and trade cooperation with foreign countries.
And Matisse says if elected president, the removal of the sanctions will be among the priorities of his administration. He believes economic growth is impossible without global exchanges. The presidential candidate has vowed to get Financial Action Task Force, or FATF, passed if he wins the presidential election. Hemati has also pledged to work to minimize Iran's reliance on foreign policy, or I'm sorry, on foreign imports. Next, we're going to talk about Ebrahim Raisi. He is a prominent Iranian cleric. He has held several key posts in the judiciary branch since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. He was the prosecutor of the cities of Karaj, Hamadan, as well as the capital, Tehran. Raisi also served as first deputy chief of justice of Iran and the attorney general of the country. In March 2016, Raisi became the chairman of Ostan Quds Razavi, and in 2019, he was appointed as the judiciary chief, a post he currently serves. The prominent cleric is one of the candidates running for the 2021 presidential election in Iran. He is running on a platform of tackling economic problems such as poverty, unemployment, and inflation. Let's take a listen.
My administration will have no red line in fighting corruption. The root cause of injustices in the executive branch of the government must be dried up. The banking, tax, import, and export systems must be reformed.
On the country's economy, Raisi says the current conditions are unacceptable since people are not able to predict their financial situation due to constant fluctuations. He has unveiled a plan on economic recovery. Let's take a listen.
My economic plan can be summed up in three main points. Of course, there are other important issues I will address later if time allows. But now I would like to mention these three principles, which are the most important ones. The first one is overhauling governance and fighting corruption, inefficiency, and discrimination. The second point concerns supporting underprivileged families and social strata. And the third is increasing production and boosting businesses.
Regarding the 2015 nuclear deal, Raisi says he has set an agenda for securing the removal of anti-Iran sanctions. He highlighted the need for strengthening Iran's economy in the face of sanctions or any other trauma that might afflict the country's economy. Let's listen.
The Iranian nation should do all in its power to confront those who seek to breach the Iranian nation's rights and pursue the removal of sanctions. Definitely, action should be taken to bring about the removal of the sanctions.
On foreign policy, Raisi has vowed to expand ties with countries across the globe, but says Iran's neighbors should be a priority in foreign relations.
With your help and through strong diplomacy, we can establish good relations with the regional countries and raise the volume of our exports to the neighbors to the best level. We believe in interactions with the entire world in order to solve the country's economic issues, but the regional countries should be a priority.
Next, Mohsen Rezaei. He was born in 1954. In 1980, he was appointed as the chief of the intelligence division of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC. A year later, he was appointed as the IRGC's commander-in-chief by late Imam Khomeini. Bezay assumed office when he was 27 years old and remained in the post until he announced his retirement from all of his military positions. He became a member of the Expediency Council and then its secretary in August 1997. Bezay has run unsuccessfully for president three times. In April this year, he said he would try his chance once again and announce his bid for presidency. The former IRGC commander has pledged to overhaul Iran's economy. Take a listen.
I have a plan for the elimination of poverty. I'm going to allocate 450,000 tumans of monthly cash subsidies. I will also provide cheap housing units to families and pay salaries to housewives.
The presidential hopeful has vowed to rein in the country's soaring inflation. He has criticized the current banking system in Iran and promised to conduct major reforms.
One of the first things that I will do as a president will be reforming our banking system. We will make the Central Bank of Iran independent from the government. Our banks do not follow international standards. Our banking system is very traditional.
Bezay said expanding ties with neighbors would top his foreign policy agenda if he is elected president. He says Iran can boost its economy by improving its foreign policy. Here's more.
We will adopt a regional diplomacy, and our foreign policy will focus more on regional countries. Foreign policy is successful if it boosts Iran's economy and increases Iranians' annual income.
Regarding the 2015 nuclear deal, Rezaei says he supports the agreement. However, he said the United States and other signatories to the deal need to fulfill their share of obligations.
Our government will remain committed to all international obligations. The JCPOA is an international commitment that was violated by the U.S., but we will remain committed to the deal. It is important to force the U.S. to fulfill its commitments.
Now let's move on to talk about the next presidential hopeful. Sayyid Amir Hossein Ghazizadeh Hashemi was born in 1971 in Fariman, a city in Khorasan Razavi province. Ghazizadeh Hashemi is a surgeon and an ENT specialist. The principal is politician as a member of the Iranian parliament, or Majlis, who has represented the electoral district of Mashhad and Kalat in the legislature chamber since 2008. He currently serves as the legislature's first vice speaker. Ghazizadeh Hashemi is a member of the Front of Islamic Revolution Stability Party and formerly served as the principalist party's spokesperson. Hashemi is now running for president. He has published a presidential agenda with the title of Dialogue Between the Administration and the People, under the slogan of the Administration of Peace. Like other candidates, Ghazizadeh Hashemi has spoken of his economic agenda, offering his views on how to deal with unemployment and organize the country's taxation, health, and insurance systems. He has pledged to halve the unemployment rate by creating 4 million jobs. Ghazizadeh Hashemi also believes inflation, the mother of all scourges in Iran. The 50-year-old candidate says he had already drawn up a package of 213 projects, 51 of which directly address inflation and market prices. Hashemi says his administration will be based on transparency and that each sector needs a comprehensive smart electronic data system so it can better distribute cash subsidies among those in need. He says the roots of the challenges plaguing the country's economy have to be diagnosed so that the government can take the necessary measures to tackle those problems. Let's listen.
We need to take a closer look at the root causes of our economic problems. As you can see, there is a lack of overall balance. This is the case about unemployment, which has different rates in different parts of Iran. You can see the unemployment rate has been on the rise over the past 4 to 5 decades. You can also see how our production sector has been on the decline. The services sector, especially the civil servants and its statistical numbers, these all indicate a lack of balance in education sector, housing, etc. This is because our resources are distributed unfairly in the country. People blame all these mismanagement cases as the root causes of the country's current economic crisis.
The But what plans does Amir Hossein Qasizadeh Hashemi have with regard to Iran's foreign policy? The presidential candidate says the main focus of his government will be to establish and boost trade relations with African and Latin American countries. He says his administration will make the best use of foreign assets to improve the economy. The principalist candidate believes diplomacy has to be at the service of the country's economy.
We also want diplomacy for the economy and nothing else. The foreign ministry is most valuable to us when it manages to pave the way for economic exchanges with other countries.
Well, that's a wrap for now. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Well, that was amid with election specials and elections happening tomorrow. Yemeni army says it has carried out a fresh retaliatory drone strike on the Abha International Airport in Saudi Arabia's Asir province. Army spokesman General Yahya Saria said that two Qassem 2K drones successfully hit military positions at the airport. The attack was conducted in response to the kingdom's aggression and continued siege of Yemen. Saudi Arabia launched a deadly war on its southern neighbor in March 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. The war has left tens of thousands of Yemenis dead, many of them women and children. Security forces in Ivory Coast financial capital have fired tear gas at supporters of former President Laurent Gbagbo. Crowds had gathered in Abidjan to welcome Gbagbo, who is returning home after 10 years of exile. The former leader, who came to power in 2000, was arrested in 2011, a year after his refusal to accept election defeat sparked a bloody civil war. In 2019, Gbagbo was exonerated at the International Criminal Court of charges including war crimes and crimes against humanity. He is still facing a 20-year prison sentence at home on charges of financial misconduct. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
The FBI is pursuing potentially hundreds more suspects in the Capitol riot, the agency's director told Congress on Tuesday, 15th of June, calling the effort to find those responsible for the deadly assault one of the most far-reaching and extensive investigations in the Bureau's history. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Luke Broadwater. The piece is titled, FBI is pursuing hundreds in Capitol riot inquiry Ray tells Congress. The FBI is pursuing potentially hundreds more suspects in the Capitol riot, the agency's director told Congress on Tuesday, 15th of June, calling the effort to find those responsible for the deadly assault on Congress one of the most far-reaching and extensive investigations in the Bureau's history. We've already arrested close to 500, and we have hundreds of investigations that are still ongoing beyond those 500, Christopher A. Wray, FBI's Director General, told the House Oversight Committee. Christopher Wray's assurances of how seriously the agency was taking the attack by a pro-Trump mob came as lawmakers pressed him and military commanders on why they did not do more to prevent the siege, despite threats from extremists to commit violence. The threats, I would say, were everywhere, said Representative Carolyn Maloney, a New York Democrat who is the chairwoman of the House Oversight Committee. The system was blinking red. Representative Caroline Maloney confronted FBI Director Christopher Wray with messages from the social media site Parler, which she said referred to threats of violence to the FBI more than 50 times before the attack on 6th of January. One message which Ms. Maloney said Parler had sent to an FBI liaison officer on 2nd of January was from a poster who warned, "Don't be surprised if we take the Capitol building, and Trump needs us to cause chaos to enact the Insurrection Act." "I do not recall hearing about this particular email," Christopher Wray replied. "I'm not aware of Parler ever trying to contact my office." In hearings before two congressional committees on Tuesday, 15th of June, lawmakers sought new information about the security failures that helped lead to the violence. At one hearing, Caroline Maloney presented her committee's research into the delayed response of the National Guard, which showed that the Capitol Police and Washington officials made 12 urgent requests for their support, and that army leaders told the National Guard to stand by 5 times as the violence escalated. "That response took far too long," Carolyn Maloney said. "This is a shocking failure." Documents obtained by the committee showed that beginning at 1:30 p.m. on Wednesday, 6th of January, top officials at the Defense Department, the Pentagon, received pleas for help from the Capitol Police Chief, Mayor Muriel Bowser, of Washington, and other officials. But the National Guard did not arrive until 5:20 p.m., more than 4 hours later after the Capitol perimeter had been breached. The National Guard was literally waiting, all ready to go, and they didn't receive the green light for a critical time period, hours on end, said Representative Rohana, a Democrat of California and a member of the House Oversight Committee. Lawmakers had tough questions for General Charles Flynn, who commands the U.S. Army Pacific, and Lieutenant General Walter E. Piatt, the director of the Army staff, both of whom were involved in a key phone call with police leaders during the riot, in which Army officials worried aloud about the optics of sending in the National Guard. According to those involved, it was the first time lawmakers had heard from either general. In their testimony, they described a frantic call in which the chief of the Capitol Police and the Metropolitan Police became agitated as they tried unsuccessfully to get military support whilst rioters attacked their officers at the Capitol building. "Both speakers on the phone sounded highly agitated and even panicked," General Flynn recalled. By contrast, he said, General Piatt was a calm and combat-experienced leader, General Piatt has defended his caution in initially advising against sending in the National Guard, telling the committee that he was definitely concerned in the days before 6th of January about the public perception of using soldiers to secure the election process in any manner that could be viewed as political. He told the committee that the National Guard forces were not trained, prepared, or equipped to conduct this type of law enforcement operation. When people's lives are on the line, 2 minutes is too long, General Piatt said. But we were not positioned for that urgent request. We had to re-prepare so we would send them in prepared for this new mission. General Flynn is the brother of Michael Flynn, President Donald Trump's disgraced former national security advisor, who has emerged as one of the former president's biggest promoters of the lie of a stolen election. In submitted testimony, General Flynn said he had not participated in the call, but merely overheard portions of it when he entered the room whilst it was in progress. He said that he had not heard any discussion of political considerations with regards to sending in the National Guard. I did not use the word optics, nor did I hear the word used during the call on 6th of January 2021, he said. The panel did not hear testimony from the acting chief of the Capitol Police, Yogananda Pittman, who declined to attend, citing her need to hear testimony at the other hearing before the House Administration Committee. Republicans were quick to criticize her decision and repeatedly referred to her absence during the session, which stretched into the evening. Representative Caroline Maloney said she was also disappointed, but she added that Police Chief Pittman had committed to testifying on 21st of July. In a simultaneous session on Tuesday afternoon, the House Administration Committee heard testimony from Michael Bolton, the Capitol Police Inspector General, and Greta Goodwin, the Director of Homeland Security and Justice for the Government Accountability Office. Michael Bolton testified about his fourth investigative report into the failures of 6th of January, which found that the department's tactical unit did not have access to adequate training facilities or adequate policies in place for securing ballistic helmets and vests. 24 were stolen during the riot. The agency's first responder unit was also not equipped with adequate, less lethal weapons, among other findings. Michael Bolton's reports found that the Capitol Police had clearer warnings about the riot than were previously known, including the potential for violence in which Congress itself is the target. He also revealed that police officers were instructed by their leaders not to use their most aggressive tactics to hold off the mob, in part because they feared that they lacked the training to handle the equipment needed to do so. About 140 police officers were injured during the attack on 6th of January, and 7 people died in connection with the siege, including one police officer who had multiple strokes after sparring with rioters.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Brother Hasnain Rajab Ali.
I begin in Allah's name, the Beneficent, the Merciful. If you ponder in this verse, إِنَّمَا الْمُؤْمِنُونَ الَّذِينَ إِذَا ذُكِّرُ اللَّهُ وَجِلَتْ قُلُوبُهُمْ وَإِذَا تُلِيَتْ عَلَيْهِمْ آيَاتُهُ زَادَتْهُمْ إِيمَانًا وَعَلَىٰ رَبِّهِمْ يَتَوَكَّلُونَ. The last piece, وَعَلَىٰ رَبِّهِمْ يَتَوَكَّلُونَ, is the ultimate. When you and I live a life of tawakkul, we'll talk about tawakkul. It's a whole conversation, series of conversations, where you have trust in Allah, where you take off from that diving board and you spin in the air with perfection, having trust that you will land perfectly on the floor. I mean, inside the pool. You will see that, or if you're a gymnast, you would land perfectly on the floor. You will find that that trust where you are now jumping off the trampoline is an indicator that you believe in the system. But you didn't do it until you validated the system. You questioned it. You tested the equipment. You tested the springboard. And then you took off. This conversation is at that level. And let us pray to Allah that when, you know, in Allah in Surah Al Imran, verse number 8, says, رَبَّنَا لَا تُزِغْ قُلُوبَنَا بَعْدَ إِذْ هَدَيْتَنَا. Our Lord, do not let our hearts go astray after you've guided it. What can we do to increase this gravity of the conversation at the heart level? And I conclude on this simple fact that when we talk to each other, when a husband and wife, have relationships, when you have relationships with your children, children have relationships with their parents, siblings, try to relate to each other at the heart level. Many times I'll see a kid and say, oh, I hate my sister, or I hate my brother. Why? Oh, he gets on my nerves. I say, what do you mean? Oh, he's a bother, you know. I wish he wasn't there. And they will use the word, and then the way they say it, I hate, you know, they make this face, I hate him. And I look at that and I say, you know, that's not true. I say, well, what do you mean that's not true? Oh, I can't stand my brother. All that conversation is at the mind level, is at the surface level. This child does not hate their brother or sister. Promise. It's like sometimes they say, oh, I hate my parents. No, you don't. That is where shaitan has played at the surface level. So I say to this person, I say, okay, you hate your sister? I said, yes. I said, if your sister is in the hospital right now and is about to die, will you go visit her? You look at me? Of course. I said, but I thought you hate her. I mean, you should be happy that she should die. You should be happy that she's in the hospital. No. No, of course I'll go. I said, but your sister now maybe needs your kidney. Would you give it to her? Of course. She needs your blood, would you? Of course. Of course. I said, if your sister died, would you cry? Of course. I said, what happened to the hate? See, the second conversation is at the heart level. How do we engage that? How do we as a human race go there? Why have we built so many facades in our communication skills and in our social skills where we fool each other at the level of this conversation, where it's so surface that it leads to all kinds of corruption in society when we really didn't intend to? It was just a concoction of the mind. You know, one time, I'll give you an example. A child was playing soccer with another child, and one of them kicked him. You know, soccer, you get hurt. You get kicked, the ball hits you. You know, they go to the gym, they come back, they've got a bruise on their face. And when you look at that, it's anger. He hit me with that ball. Was it intentional? Well, I don't care. He hit me. Okay. I mean, you're playing a game. And the rule of the game is it's a wild, you know, possibility. That ball can fly anywhere. Like, I know when I walk through the gym, when kids are playing, hey, be ready. A ball can fall in your head just now. Just watch out. That's the way the world works. But when the ball does hit you, you can't go to the person and say, you know, I'm going to take you to court. I'm going to sue you because you hit me with a ball. Of course, if it's intentional, where you take the ball and you aim it at the person, it's a different matter, but in general. Now, this kid got into a bit of a brawl, and he comes and he kicks the other kid, and this kid is crying, and he comes and says, look, this person hit me. They were kids. They were like 8, 9 years old. So I said to the boy, I said, you know, why'd you hit him? He says, he took my ball. He came in the way and took the ball. I said, but that's the game. You know, the game is you take the ball. And he said, yeah, but my father told me, anybody takes anything away from me, I should hit them back. I said, I need to talk to your father, of course. There's something wrong with that training. Of course, protect yourself from bullies, but not to this level. Come on. But this kid was so firm in his ways. You know, he was protecting his integrity. And that's beautiful, by the way. When children protect themselves from abuse. I like that. That's beautiful. They're not, they're not what we call docile, where people can abuse them. They know how to guard themselves, and that's beautiful. Inshallah, as they grow older, they'll become even more able to manage themselves. But this attitude could tip over on the other side, and you could end up becoming a bully and a fiend and, you know, God forbid, nefarious in your activities. So what happened is that I said to him, and he was very, very confident, and I said, what if I told you that boy is sick, or his mother is sick, and that, and the boy's mother, by the way, was sick. I said, you know, what if I told you that his mother is sick, or he is sick, and that you hit him, and maybe you could have hurt him really badly. And the boy looked at me, and the conversation went straight to the heart. It was no longer this mental processing, it was in the heart. And the child calmed down. His demeanor was like this. He went like this. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, what if he's sick, or his mother is sick, and she may die soon? Oh, well, and then in that case, he can have the ball at any time. If he wants the ball, he can have it at any time. I said, you're willing to give him the ball? You're just telling me right now that your dad told you. Yeah, yeah, no, under this case, please, you can have the ball. And the kid actually got teary-eyed. Look at how a kid who appears to be rough and tough, look at how the heart is soft. You know, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, مَا جَفَّتِ الدَّمُ إِلَّا لِكَسْرَةِ الْقُلُوبِ وَمَا قَسَتِ الْقُلُوبِ إِلَّا لِكَثَّةِ الذُّنُوبِ. Hearts don't get hard until they're filled with sin. And in other words, tears don't come out when hearts are hard. Hearts don't get hard until they're filled with sin. كَثَّةِ الذُّنُوبِ. This is a child, sinless. You talk to them, they start to have tears coming out. That's the heart talking. وَجِلَتْ قُلُوبُهُمْ. See? And he felt that compassion for that boy, felt the compassion for the boy's mother. That's the resonance we're talking about in this conversation. How do you and I, even to go watch a Hollywood movie that may be completely fictional, how do you and I look at it and say that when you watch something and a child is being abused or family is being abused in that movie, that it hurts you and you start to cry? You know, even though it's fictional, the principle is not fictional. That's the level we want. Not the level when Allah says, وَإِذَا تُلِيَتْ عَلَيْهِمْ آيَاتُ وَلَّا مُسْتَكْبِرًا كَأَنْ لَمْ يَسْمَعْهَا كَأَنَّ فِي أُذُنَيْهِ وَقْرًا. When you recite these verses to them, they turn away like they haven't heard you, like as if there's a heaviness in the ear. What does Allah say about them in Surah Al-Baqarah? فِي قُلُوبِهِمْ مَرَضٌ فَزَادَهُمُ اللَّهُ مَرَضٌ. In their hearts is a disease, and God has increased their disease. Why? They are insistent on rejecting the mercy of God, so their hearts have become hard. And you know, we all know, the worst relationship on earth, if you want to look at an anathema, a curse, is when you meet a hard-hearted person. Oh my God, when you watch movies, what makes us cringe is those cruel, ruthless, you know, slave owners who used to whip people. And they were so wicked that everything was planned around destruction in a satanic way. I want us to imagine both sides and beg to God, my Lord, I want to be that one who submits, who cries, whose heart is always soft, always sheds tears when you hear something sad. You are always ready to put your hands in your pocket and to go feed the poor. And then when you feed, you feel so happy. But you don't want to tell the world because you're excited that that's your little secret with God.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen. وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The G7 summit, which ended on Sunday, 13th of June in Cornwall, England, achieved much less than campaigners had hoped, with no significant new cash forthcoming for the world's poorest countries and most vulnerable countries on the front lines of climate breakdown. We now present you an article written by The Guardian newspaper's environment correspondent Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled Rich Countries Urged to Come Up with Detailed Plans to Cut Emissions. One of the architects of the Paris Climate Accord has said rich countries must come forward with detailed plans on how they hope to meet their climate targets. And Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson must forge much closer relationships with developing countries to bring about the breakthrough needed on the climate crisis this year. The G7 summit, which ended on Sunday, 13th of June in Cornwall, England, achieved much less than campaigners had hoped, with no significant new cash forthcoming for the world's poorest and most vulnerable countries on the front lines of climate breakdown. There were promises by the world's richest economies to halt funding for coal, but they fell short of the pledge to end all new fossil fuel development that experts have said will be needed. The United Kingdom now has just 20 weeks to forge a global consensus on the climate crisis before the United Nations climate talks called COP26 to be held in Glasgow, Scotland this November. COP26 will be the most important climate meeting since the Paris Climate Accord was signed in 2015 and one of the last chances to put the world on track to meet its goal of limiting temperature rises to just 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Lawrence Tubiana, the chief executive of the European Climate Foundation, who was the top French diplomat in charge of the 2015 Paris Climate Accord, said the key was for rich countries to build trust among other countries by drawing up detailed plans on how to meet their own targets on greenhouse gas emissions and come up with improved offers of finance for the most vulnerable countries. She told The Guardian, COP26 will be the moment of truth. Countries have to display their precise plans and accountability mechanisms to ensure that greenhouse gas emissions cuts take place. There is a lot of work to do to deliver this. We are at the end of the era of coal, oil and gas burning, and that shift has to start in earnest. Lawrence Tobiana added, leaders will need to use the next 4 months before they meet again at the COP26 summit in Glasgow, Scotland, to crack on with fleshing out the details of this global Marshall Plan for green recovery and getting everyone everywhere vaccinated. And crucially, that means putting up the investment to make all of this possible. G7 meeting left Boris Johnson looking exposed on the world stage to some observers. Pledges by the G7 club of the richest countries, the United Kingdom, United States, Japan, Canada, Germany, France, Italy, and the European Union, on vaccines were disappointing to many. And the summit was overshadowed by tensions over Brexit and the Northern Ireland Protocol. The UK row about overseas aid spending, which Boris Johnson is cutting from 0.7% of gross domestic product to 0.5% with a loss of £4 billion to the developing world, also put him in a poor position to browbeat his fellow leaders into stumping up more cash for climate finance. Poor nations were promised $100 billion a year from the rich world to help them cut greenhouse gas emissions and cope with the impact of climate breakdown. But that long-standing pledge has fallen short by about $20 billion. Mohamed Addo, the director of the Power Shift Africa think tank, said, it's clear the G7 was a huge disappointment and it had undermined Boris Johnson's credibility. It's hard not to think that the host of COP26 cutting their aid budget is going to undermine efforts to raise climate finance from other countries. Overpromising and underdelivering is a bad look for the man overseeing the biggest climate talks since the Paris Climate Agreement. Salim Ul-Haq, the director of the International Center for Climate Change and Development in Bangladesh, said, the United Kingdom, having reneged on their own parliamentary act on overseas aid, made the situation of Boris Johnson as chair of the G7 non-credible for the other leaders. All of this does not bode well for the COP26 summit in Glasgow. Laurence Tobiana, the chief executive of the European Climate Foundation, said Boris Johnson must do much more to reassure the developing world. At COP26 in Glasgow, every one of the 196 signatory countries to the Paris Climate Accord has, in theory at least, an equal say. And a deal can only be forged by consensus, so developing countries can make or break any compromise. She said, you have to deliver a signal to developing countries that they are taken seriously. Overseas aid is not just about aid, it is about political outreach, and it shows developing countries that they have a seat at the table, alongside the United States and China and so on. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson can take comfort from the fact that the road to the Paris Climate Agreement was far from smooth. Laurence Tobiana recalls that a key meeting of the leaders of the G20 nations, the G7 and 13 other smaller economies, including China, India, Russia, Brazil, Australia, Saudi Arabia, South Africa, and Turkey, just weeks before the climatic summit in Paris in December of 2015 went pretty badly. She said, 6 months before the Paris Climate Accord, it was super pessimistic. People thought there would not be an ambitious agreement. She added, and the G20 just before Paris was a disaster. After the G20, anyone would have said it is not worth even going to Paris. Yet, with the so-called painstaking diplomacy, the French repaired the tensions and managed to achieve a global consensus in the final weeks. The previous 2 years had been spent carefully listening to developing countries' concerns and building reserves of trust that meant the French were seen supposedly as honest brokers for a fair deal. Given the outcome of the G7, Boris Johnson must hope he has as much credit to draw upon.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Leader's speech in meeting with members of Assembly of Experts. This is part of a speech delivered on August 31, 2006 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with members of the Assembly of Experts.
I remember that during the auspicious life of Hazrat Imam, may God bestow paradise on him, different individuals from different organizations, whether ministries or other organizations, went to Imam and made certain complaints. They used to say that there are such and such flaws in certain areas. In response, Imam used to say to them, well, the task is difficult. This is true. There is a great distance between wishing and having the capability and between having the capability and achieving. We may want to do many things, but the path is long and it has certain prerequisites. We should not show impatience in the process of meeting these prerequisites. If it becomes clear that effort is being made and that the orientation is correct, we should wait so that by Allah's favor, we can achieve results. Good tasks are being carried out in the areas that the gentleman in this meeting referred to. Fortunately, officials are not indifferent towards the moral, cultural, and bureaucratic issues of society. They feel the existing shortcomings and maladies and they think about them. They are after curing them and they will achieve results. Of course, some of their results may be correct and some may be wrong. Some of their solutions may be effective and some may not be effective. These are always possible in all tasks. Until we get there, we have difficult tasks ahead of us. The last point that I would like to raise is the concerns that I have about the issue of slandering during the time of elections in our country. Unfortunately, it is some time now that it has become common. I am really concerned about the orientations that are adopted here and there. This does not mean that the people who do this are many. In fact, there are a few people who do this, but even the activities of those few people damage the environment of society.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah. Praises to
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.